While Justinian laboured for the public service, he was not unmindful of his own dignity and ease. The Byzantine palace, which had been damaged by the conflagration, was restored with new magnificence, and some notion may be conceived of the whole edifice by the vestibule, or hall, which, from the doors, perhaps, or the roof, was surnamed Calce, or the Brazen. The dome of a spacious quadrangle was supported by massy pillars. The pavement and walls were encrusted with many-coloured marbles, the emerald green of Laconia, the fiery red, and the white Phrygian stone intersected with veins of a sea-green hue. The mosaic paintings of the dome and sides represented the glories of the African and Italian triumphs. On the Asiatic shore of the Propontis, at a small distance to the east of Chalcedon, the costly palace and gardens of Hyrum were prepared for the summer residence of Justinian, and more especially of Theodora. The poets of the age have celebrated the rare alliance of nature and art, the harmony of the nymphs of the groves, the fountains, and the waves. Yet the crowd of attendants who followed the court complained of their inconvenient lodgings, and the nymphs were too often alarmed by the famous Porphyrio, a whale of 10 cubits in breadth and 30 in length, who was stranded at the mouth of the river Sangaris after he had infested more than half a century the seas of Constantinople. The fortifications of Europe and Asia were multiplied by Justinian, but the repetition of those timid and fruitless precautions exposes to a philosophic eye the debility of the empire. From Belgrade to the Black Sea, from the conflux of the Save to the mouth of the Danube, a chain of above 80 fortified places was extended along the banks of the great river. Single watchtowers were changed into spacious citadels. Vacant walls, which the engineers contracted or enlarged according to the nature of the ground, were filled with colonies or garrisons. A strong fortress defended the ruins of Trajan's Bridge, and several military stations affected to spread beyond the Danube the pride of the Roman name. But that name was divested of its terrors. The barbarians and their annual inroads passed and contemptuously repassed before these useless bulwarks, and the inhabitants of the frontier, instead of reposing under the shadow of the general defense, were compelled to guard with incessant vigilance their separate habitations. The solitude of ancient cities was replenished. The new foundations of Justinian acquired, perhaps too hastily, the epithets of impregnable and populous. And the auspicious place of his own nativity attracted the ungrateful reverence of the vainest of princes. Under the name of Justiniana Prima, the obscure village of Tarisium became the seat of an archbishop and a prefect, whose jurisdiction extended over 7 warlike provinces of Illyricum, and the corrupt appellation of Justendil still indicates, about 20 miles to the south of Sofia, the residence of a Turkish sanjak. For the use of the emperor's countrymen, a cathedral, a palace and an aqueduct were speedily constructed. The public and private edifices were adapted to the greatness of a royal city, and the strength of the walls resisted during the lifetime of Justinian the unskillful assaults of the Huns and Sclavonians. Their progress was sometimes retarded, and their hopes of rapine were disappointed by the innumerable castles which in the provinces of Dacia, Epirus, Thessaly, Macedonia, and Thrace appeared to cover the whole face of the country. 600 of these forts were built or repaired by the emperor, but it seems reasonable to believe that the far greater part consisted only of a stone or brick tower, in the midst of a square or circular area which was surrounded by a wall and ditch, and afforded, in a moment of danger, some protection to the peasants and cattle of the neighbouring villages. Yet these military works, which exhausted the public treasure, could not remove the just apprehensions of Justinian and his European subjects. The warm baths of Anchialus in Thrace were rendered as safe as they were salutary, but the rich pastures of Thessalonica were foraged by the Scythian cavalry. the delicious Vale of Tempe, 300 miles from the Danube, was continually alarmed by the sound of war, and no unfortified spot, however distant or solitary, could securely enjoy the blessings of peace. The Straits of Thermopylae, which seemed to protect, but which had so often betrayed, the safety of Greece, were diligently strengthened by the labors of Justinian. From the edge of the seashore, through the forests and valleys, and as far as the summit of the Thessalian mountains, a strong wall was continued, which occupied every practicable entrance. Instead of a hasty crowd of peasants, a garrison of 2,000 soldiers was stationed along the rampart. Granaries of corn and reservoirs of water were provided for their use, and by a precaution that inspired the cowardice which it foresaw, convenient fortresses were erected for their retreat. The walls of Corinth, overthrown by an earthquake, and the mouldering bulwarks of Athens and Plataea were carefully restored. The barbarians were discouraged by the prospect of successive and painful sieges, and the naked cities of Peloponnesus were covered by the fortifications of the isthmus of Corinth. At the extremity of Europe, another peninsula, the Thracian Chersonesus, runs 3 days' journey into the sea to form, with the adjacent shores of Asia, the Straits of the Hellespont. The intervals between 11 populous towns were filled by lofty woods, fair pastures, and arable lands, and the isthmus of 37 stadia, or furlongs, had been fortified by a Spartan general 900 years before the reign of Justinian. In an age of freedom and valor, the slightest rampart may prevent a surprise, and Procopius appears insensible of the superiority of ancient times when he praises the solid construction and double parapet of a wall whose long arms stretched on either side into the sea, but whose strength was deemed insufficient to guard the Chersonesus if each city, and particularly Gallipoli and Sestis, had not been secured by their peculiar fortifications. The long wall, as it was emphatically styled, was a work as disgraceful in the object as it was respectable in the execution. The riches of a capital diffused themselves over the neighboring country, and the territory of Constantinople, a paradise of nature, was adorned with the luxurious gardens and villas of the senators and opulent citizens. But their wealth served only to attract the bold and rapacious barbarians. The noblest of the Romans, in the bosom of peaceful indolence, were led away into Scythian captivity, and their sovereign might view from his palace the hostile flames which were insolently spread to the gates of the imperial city. At the distance only of 40 miles, Anastasius was constrained to establish a last frontier. His long wall of 60 miles from the Propontis to the Black Sea proclaimed the impotence of his arms. And as the danger became more imminent, new fortifications were added by the indefatigable prudence of Justinian. Asia Minor, after the submission of the Isaurians, remained without enemies and without fortifications. Those bold savages who had disdained to be the subjects of Gallienus persisted 230 years in a life of independence and rapine. The most successful princes respected the strength of the mountains and the despair of the natives. Their fierce spirit was sometimes soothed with gifts and sometimes restrained by terror. And a military count with 3 legions fixed his permanent and ignominious station in the heart of the Roman provinces. But no sooner was the vigilance of power relaxed or diverted than the light-armed squadrons descended from the hills and invaded the peaceful plenty of Asia. Although the Isaurians were not remarkable for stature or bravery, want rendered them bold, and experience made them skillful in the exercise of predatory war. They advanced with secrecy and speed to the attack of villages and defenseless towns. Their flying parties have sometimes touched the Hellespont, the Black Sea, and the gates of Tarsus, Antioch, or Damascus. And the spoil was lodged in their inaccessible mountains before the Roman troops had received their orders, or the distant province had computed its loss. The guilt of rebellion and robbery excluded them from the rights of national enemies, and the magistrates were instructed by an edict that the trial or punishment of an Isaurian, even on the festival of Easter, was a meritorious act of justice and piety. If the captives were condemned to domestic slavery, they maintained, with their sword or dagger, the private quarrel of their masters. And it was found expedient for the public tranquillity to prohibit the service of such dangerous retainers. When their countryman, Tarquilius, or Zeno, ascended the throne, he invited a faithful and formidable band of Isaurians, who insulted the court and city, and were rewarded by an annual tribute of 5,000 pounds of gold. But the hopes of fortune depopulated the mountains. Luxury innovated the hardiness of their minds and bodies, and in proportion as they mixed with mankind, they became less qualified for the enjoyment of poor and solitary freedom. After the death of Zeno, his successor Anastasius suppressed their pensions, exposed their persons to the revenge of the people, banished them from Constantinople, and prepared to sustain a war which left only the alternative of victory or servitude. A brother of the last emperor usurped the title of Augustus. His cause was powerfully supported by the arms, the treasures, and the magazines collected by Zeno, and the native Isaurians must have formed the smallest portion of the 150,000 barbarians under his standard, which was sanctified for the first time by the presence of a fighting bishop. Their disorderly numbers were vanquished in the plains of Phrygia by the valour and discipline of the Goths. But a war of 6 years almost exhausted the courage of the emperor. The Isaurians retired to their mountains. Their fortresses were successively besieged and ruined. Their communication with the sea was intercepted. The bravest of their leaders died in arms. The surviving chiefs, before their execution, were dragged in chains through the hippodrome. A colony of their youth was transplanted into Thrace, and the remnant of the people submitted to the Roman government. Yet some generations elapsed before their minds were reduced to the level of slavery. The populous villages of Mount Taurus were filled with horsemen and archers. They resisted the imposition of tributes, but they recruited the armies of Justinian, and his civil magistrates, the proconsul of Cappadocia, the count of Isauria, and the praetors of Lycaonia and Pisidia, were invested with military power to restrain the licentious practice of rapes and assassinations. Part 5. If we extend our view from the tropic to the mouth of the Tanais, we may observe, on one hand, the precautions of Justinian to curb the savages of Ethiopia, and on the other, the long walls which he constructed in Crimea for the protection of his friendly Goths, a colony of 3,000 shepherds and warriors. From that peninsula to Trebizond, the eastern curve of the Black Sea was secured by forts, by alliance, or by religion. And the possession of Lazica, the Colchos of ancient, the Mingrelia of modern geography, soon became the object of an important war. Trebizond, in after times the seat of a romantic empire, was indebted to the liberality of Justinian for a church, an aqueduct, and a castle, whose ditches are hewn in the solid rock. From that maritime city, a frontier line of 500 miles may be drawn to the fortress of Circesium, the last Roman station on the Euphrates. Above Trebizond, immediately and 5 days' journey to the south, the country rises into dark forests and craggy mountains, as savage though not so lofty as the Alps and the Pyrenees. In this rigorous climate, where the snows seldom melt, the fruits are tardy and tasteless. Even honey is poisonous. The most industrious tillage would be confined to some pleasant valleys, and the pastoral tribes obtained a scanty sustenance from the flesh and milk of their cattle. The Chalybians derived their name and temper from the iron quality of the soil, and since the days of Cyrus they might produce, under the various appellations of Cadians and Zanians, an uninterrupted prescription of war and rapine. Under the reign of Justinian, they acknowledged the god and the emperor of the Romans, and 7 fortresses were built in the most accessible passages to exclude the ambition of the Persian monarch. The principal source of the Euphrates descends from the Calabrian mountains and seems to flow towards the west and the Black Sea. Bending to the southwest, the river passes under the walls of Satala and Melitene, which were restored by Justinian as the bulwarks of the Lesser Armenia, and gradually approaches the Mediterranean Sea, till at length, repelled by Mount Taurus, the Euphrates inclines its long and flexible course to the southeast and the Gulf of Persia. Among the Roman cities beyond the Euphrates, we distinguish 2 recent foundations which were named from Theodosius, and the relics of the martyrs, and 2 capitals, Amida and Edessa, which are celebrated in the history of every age. Their strength was proportioned by Justinian to the danger of the situation. A ditch and palisade might be sufficient to resist the artless force of the cavalry of Scythia, but more elaborate works were required to sustain a regular siege against the arms and treasures of the great king. His skillful engineers understood the methods of conducting deep mines and of raising platforms to the level of the rampart. He shook the strongest battlements with his military engines, and sometimes advanced to the assault with a line of movable turrets on the backs of elephants. In the great cities of the east, the disadvantage of space, perhaps of position, was compensated by the zeal of the people who seconded the garrison in the defense of their country and religion, and the fabulous promise of the Son of God that Edessa should never be taken filled the citizens with valiant confidence and chilled the besiegers with doubt and dismay. The subordinate towns of Armenia and Mesopotamia were diligently strengthened, and the posts which appeared to have any command of ground or water were occupied by numerous forts substantially built of stone, or more hastily erected with the obvious materials of earth and brick. The eye of Justinian investigated every spot, and his cruel precautions might attract the war into some lonely vale whose peaceful natives, connected by trade and marriage, were ignorant of national discord and the quarrels of princes. Westward of the Euphrates, a sandy desert extends above 600 miles to the Red Sea. Nature had interposed a vacant solitude between the ambition of 2 rival empires. The Arabians, till Muhammad arose, were formidable only as robbers, and in the proud security of peace the fortifications of Syria were neglected on the most vulnerable side. But the national enmity, at least the effects of that enmity, had been suspended by a truce which continued above 40 years. An ambassador from the Emperor Zeno accompanied the rash and unfortunate Perozes in his expedition against the Nephalites, or White Huns, whose conquests had been stretched from the Caspian to the heart of India, whose throne was enriched with emeralds, and whose cavalry was supported by a line of 2,000 elephants. The Persians were twice circumvented in a situation which made valor useless and flight impossible, and the double victory of the Huns was achieved by military stratagem. They dismissed their royal captive after he had submitted to adore the majesty of a barbarian, and the humiliation was poorly evaded by the casuistical subtlety of the Magi, who instructed Perozes to direct his attention to the rising sun. The indignant successor of Cyrus forgot his danger and his gratitude. He renewed the attack with headstrong fury and lost both his army and his life. The death of Perozes abandoned Persia to her foreign and domestic enemies, and 12 years of confusion elapsed before his son, Kabades, or Kobad, could embrace any designs of ambition or revenge. The unkind parsimony of Anastasius was the motive or pretense of a Roman war. The Huns and Arabs marched under the Persian standard, and the fortifications of Armenia and Mesopotamia were at that time in a ruinous or imperfect condition. The emperor returned his thanks to the governor and people of Martyropolis for the prompt surrender of a city which could not be successfully defended. Then the conflagration of Theodosiopolis might justify the conduct of their prudent neighbors. Amida sustained a long and destructive siege, At the end of 3 months, the loss of 50,000 of the soldiers of Kabedes was not balanced by any prospect of success, and it was in vain that the Magi deduced a flattering prediction from the indecency of the women on the ramparts, who had revealed their most sacred charms to the eyes of the assailants. At length, in a silent night, they ascended the most accessible tower, which was guarded only by some monks, oppressed, after the duties of a festival, with sleep and wine. Scaling ladders were applied at the dawn of day. The presence of Kabedes, his stern command, and his drawn sword, compelled the Persians to vanquish, and before it was sheathed, 40,000 of the inhabitants had expiated the blood of their companions. After the siege of Amida, the war continued 3 years, and the unhappy frontier tasted the full measure of its calamities. The gold of Anastasius was offered too late. The number of his troops was defeated by the number of their generals. The country was stripped of its inhabitants, and both the living and the dead were abandoned to the wild beasts of the desert. The resistance of Edessa and the deficiency of spoil inclined the mind of Kabedes to peace. He sold his conquest for an exorbitant price, and the same line, though marked with slaughter and devastation, still separated the two empires. To avert the repetition of the same evils, Anastasius resolved to found a new colony, so strong that it should defy the power of the Persian, so far advanced towards Assyria that its stationary troops might defend the province by the menace or operation of offensive war. For this purpose, the town of Dara, 14 miles from Nisibis and 4 days' journey from the Tigris, was peopled and adorned. The hasty works of Anastasius were improved by the perseverance of Justinian, and without insisting on places less important, the fortifications of Dara may represent the military architecture of the age. The city was surrounded with 2 walls, and the interval between them, of 50 paces, afforded a retreat to the cattle of the besieged. The inner wall was a monument of strength and beauty. It measured 60 feet from the ground, and the height of the towers was 100 feet. The loopholes, from whence an enemy might be annoyed with missile weapons, were small, but numerous. The soldiers were planted along the rampart under the shelter of double galleries, and a 3rd platform, spacious and secure, was raised on the summit of the towers. The exterior wall appears to have been less lofty but more solid, and each tower was protected by a quadrangular bulwark. A hard, rocky soil resisted the tools of the miners, and on the southeast, where the ground was more tractable, their approach was retarded by a new work which advanced in the shape of a half-moon. The double and treble ditches were filled with a stream of water, and in the management of the river the most skillful labor was employed to supply the inhabitants, to distress the besiegers, and to prevent the mischiefs of a natural or artificial inundation. Dara continued more than 60 years to fulfill the wishes of its founders, and to provoke the jealousy of the Persians, who incessantly complained that this impregnable fortress had been constructed in manifest violation of the treaty of peace between the two empires. Between the Black Sea and the Caspian, the countries of Colchis, Iberia, and Albania are intersected in every direction by the branches of Mount Caucasus, and the 2 principal gates or passes from north to south have been frequently confounded in the geography, both of the ancients and moderns. The name of Caspian or Albanian gates is properly applied to Derbend, which occupies a short declivity between the mountains and the sea. The city, if we give credit to local tradition, had been founded by the Greeks, and this dangerous entrance was fortified by the kings of Persia with a mole, double walls, and doors of iron. The Iberian gates are formed by a narrow passage of 6 miles in Mount Caucasus, which opens from the northern side of Iberia, or Georgia, into the plain that reaches to the Tanais and the Volga. A fortress designed by Alexander, perhaps, or one of his successors, to command that important pass, had descended by right of conquest or inheritance to a prince of the Huns, who offered it for a moderate price to the emperor. But while Anastasius paused, while he timorously computed the cost and the distance, a more vigilant rival interposed, and Kabades forcibly occupied the Straits of Caucasus. The Albanian and Iberian gates excluded the horsemen of Scythia from the shortest and most practicable roads, and the whole front of the mountains was covered by the rampart of Gog and Magog, the long wall which has excited the curiosity of an Arabian caliph and a Russian conqueror. According to a recent description, huge stones, 7 feet thick and 21 feet in length or height, are artificially joined without iron or cement to compose a wall which runs above 300 miles from the shores of Derbend, over the hills and through the valleys of Dagestan and Georgia. Without a vision, such a work might be undertaken by the policy of Kabades. Without a miracle, it might be accomplished by his son, so formidable to the Romans, under the name of Khosroes, so dear to the Orientals under the appellation of Nushirwan. The Persian monarch held in his hand the keys, both of peace and war, but he stipulated in every treaty that Justinian should contribute to the expense of a common barrier, which equally protected the two empires from the inroads of the Scythians. 7. Justinian suppressed the schools of Athens and the consulship of Rome, which had given so many sages and heroes to mankind. Both these institutions had long since degenerated from their primitive glory. Yet some reproach may be justly inflicted on the avarice and jealousy of a prince by whose hand such venerable ruins were destroyed. Athens, after her Persian triumphs, adopted the philosophy of Ionia and the rhetoric of Sicily, and these studies became the patrimony of a city whose inhabitants, about 30,000 males, condensed within the period of a single life the genius of ages and millions. Our sense of the dignity of human nature is exalted by the simple recollection that Isocrates was the companion of Plato and Xenophon, that he assisted, perhaps with the historian Thucydides, at the first representation of the Oedipus of Sophocles and the Iphigenia of Euripides, and that his pupils, Aeschines and Demosthenes, contended for the crown of patriotism in the presence of Aristotle, the master of Theophrastus, who taught at Athens with the founders of the Stoic and Epicurean sects. The ingenuous youth of Attica enjoyed the benefits of their domestic education, which was communicated without envy to the rival cities. 2,000 disciples heard the lessons of Theophrastus. The schools of rhetoric must have been still more populous than those of philosophy, and a rapid succession of students diffused the fame of their teachers as far as the utmost limits of the Grecian language and name. Those limits were enlarged by the victories of Alexander. The arts of Athens survived her freedom and dominion, and the Greek colonies, which the Macedonians planted in Egypt and scattered over Asia, undertook long and frequent pilgrimages to worship the muses in their favorite temple on the banks of the Ilissus. The Latin conquerors respectfully listened to the instructions of their subjects and captives. The names of Cicero and Horace were enrolled in the schools of Athens, and after the perfect settlement of the Roman Empire, the natives of Italy, of Africa, and of Britain conversed in the groves of the academy with their fellow students of the East. The studies of philosophy and eloquence are congenial to a popular state which encourages the freedom of inquiry and submits only to the force of persuasion. In the republics of Greece and Rome, the art of speaking was the powerful engine of patriotism or ambition, and the schools of rhetoric poured forth a colony of statesmen and legislators. When the liberty of public debate was suppressed, the orator, in the honorable profession of an advocate, might plead the cause of innocence and justice. He might abuse his talents in the more profitable trade of panegyric, and the same precepts continued to dictate the fanciful declamations of the sophist and the chaster beauties of historical composition. The systems which profess to unfold the nature of God, of man, and of the universe entertain the curiosity of the philosophic student, and according to the temper of his mind he might doubt with the skeptics or decide with the Stoics, sublimely speculate with Plato, or severely urge with Aristotle. The pride of the adverse sects had fixed an unattainable term of moral happiness and perfection, but the race was glorious and salutary. The disciples of Zeno, and even those of Epicurus, were taught both to act and to suffer, and the death of Petronius was not less effectual than that of Seneca, to humble a tyrant by the discovery of his impotence. The light of science could not indeed be confined within the walls of Athens. Incomparable writers addressed themselves to the human race. The living masters emigrated to Italy and Asia. Berytus, in later times, was devoted to the study of the law. Astronomy and physic were cultivated in the Museum of Alexandria, but the Attic schools of rhetoric and philosophy maintained their superior reputation from the Peloponnesian War to the reign of Justinian. Athens, though situated in a barren soil, possessed a pure air, a free navigation, and the monuments of ancient art. That sacred retirement was seldom disturbed by the business of trade or government, and the last of the Athenians were distinguished by their lively wit, the purity of their taste and language, their social manners, and some traces, at least in discourse, of the magnanimity of their fathers. In the suburbs of the city, the Academy of the Platonists, the Lyceum of the Peripatetics, the portico of the Stoics, and the garden of the Epicureans were planted with trees and decorated with statues. And the philosophers, instead of being immured in a cloister, delivered their instructions in spacious and pleasant walks, which, at different hours, were consecrated to the exercises of the mind and body. The genius of the founders still lived in those venerable seats. The ambition of succeeding to the masters of human reason excited a generous emulation, and the merit of the candidates was determined on each vacancy by the free voices of an enlightened people. The Athenian professors were paid by their disciples. According to their mutual wants and abilities, the price appears to have varied, and Isocrates himself, who derides the avarice of the sophists, required in his school of rhetoric about 30 pounds from each of his 100 pupils. The wages of industry are just and honorable, yet the same Isocrates shed tears at the first receipt of a stipend. The Stoic might blush when he was hired to preach the contempt of money, and I should be sorry to discover that Aristotle or Plato so far degenerated from the example of Socrates as to exchange knowledge for gold. But some property of lands and houses was settled by the permission of the laws and the legacies of deceased friends on the philosophic chairs of Athens. Epicurus bequeathed to his disciples the gardens which he had purchased for 80 minae, or 250 pounds, with a fund sufficient for their frugal subsistence and monthly festivals. And the patrimony of Plato afforded an annual rent which, in 8 centuries, was gradually increased from 3 to 1,000 pieces of gold. The schools of Athens were protected by the wisest and most virtuous of the Roman princes. The library, which Hadrian founded, was placed in a portico adorned with pictures, statues, and a roof of alabaster, and supported by 100 columns of Phrygian marble. The public salaries were assigned by the generous spirit of the Antonines, and each professor of politics, of rhetoric, of the Platonic, the Peripatetic, the Stoic, and the Epicurean philosophy received an annual stipend of 10,000 drachmae, or more than £300 sterling. After the death of Marcus, these liberal donations and the privileges attached to the thrones of science were abolished and revived, diminished and enlarged. But some vestige of royal bounty may be found under the successors of Constantine, and their arbitrary choice of an unworthy candidate might tempt the philosophers of Athens to regret the days of independence and poverty. It is remarkable that the impartial favor of the Antonines was bestowed on the 4 adverse sects of philosophy which they considered as equally useful, or at least as equally innocent. Socrates had formerly been the glory and the reproach of his country, and the first lessons of Epicurus so strangely scandalized the pious ears of the Athenians that by his exile and that of his antagonists they silenced all vain disputes concerning the nature of the gods. But in the ensuing year they recalled a hasty decree, restored the liberty of the schools, and were convinced by the experience of ages that the moral character of philosophers is not affected by the diversity of their theological speculations. The Gothic arms were less fatal to the schools of Athens than the establishment of a new religion, whose ministers superseded the exercise of reason, resolved every question by an article of faith, and condemned the infidel or skeptic to eternal flames. In many a volume of laborious controversy, they exposed the weakness of the understanding and the corruption of the heart, insulted human nature in the sages of antiquity, and proscribed the spirit of philosophical inquiry so repugnant to the doctrine, or at least to the temper, of a humble believer. The surviving sects of the Platonists, whom Plato would have blushed to acknowledge, extravagantly mingled a sublime theory with the practice of superstition and magic. And as they remained alone in the midst of a Christian world, they indulged a secret rancor against the government of the church and state, whose severity was still suspended over their heads. About a century after the reign of Julian, Proclus was permitted to teach in the philosophic chair of the academy, and such was his industry that he frequently, in the same day, pronounced 5 lessons and composed 700 lines. His sagacious mind explored the deepest questions of morals and metaphysics, and he ventured to urge 18 arguments against the Christian doctrine of the creation of the world. But in the intervals of study, he personally conversed with Pan, Aesculapius, and Minerva, in whose mysteries he was secretly initiated, and whose prostrate statues he adored, in the devout persuasion that the philosopher, who is a citizen of the universe, should be the priest of its various deities. An eclipse of the sun announced his approaching end, and his life, with that of his scholar Isidore, compiled by 2 of their most learned disciples, exhibits a deplorable picture of the second childhood of human reason. Yet the golden chain, as it was fondly styled, of the Platonic succession, continued 44 years from the death of Proclus to the Edict of Justinian, which imposed a perpetual silence on the schools of Athens, and excited the grief and indignation of the few remaining votaries of Grecian science and superstition. 7 friends and philosophers, Diogenes and Hermias, Eulalius and Priscian, Damascius, Isidore and Simplicius, who dissented from the religion of their sovereign, embraced the resolution of seeking in a foreign land the freedom which was denied in their native country. They had heard, and they credulously believed, that the Republic of Plato was realized in the despotic government of Persia, and that a patriot king reigned over the happiest and most virtuous of nations. They were soon astonished by the natural discovery that Persia resembled the other countries of the globe, that Chosroes, who affected the name of a philosopher, was vain, cruel, and ambitious, that bigotry and a spirit of intolerance prevailed among the magi, that the nobles were haughty, the courtiers servile, and the magistrates unjust, that the guilty sometimes escaped, and that the innocent were often oppressed. The disappointment of the philosophers provoked them to overlook the real virtues of the Persians, and they were scandalized, more deeply perhaps than became their profession, with the plurality of wives and concubines, the incestuous marriages, and the custom of exposing dead bodies to the dogs and vultures instead of hiding them in the earth or consuming them with fire. Their repentance was expressed by a precipitate return, and they loudly declared that they had rather die on the borders of the empire than enjoy the wealth and favor of the barbarian. From this journey, however, they derived a benefit which reflects the purest luster on the character of Chosroes. He required that the 7 sages who had visited the court of Persia should be exempted from the penal laws which Justinian enacted against his pagan subjects, and this privilege, expressly stipulated in a treaty of peace, was guarded by the vigilance of a powerful mediator. Simplicius and his companions ended their lives in peace and obscurity, and as they left no disciples, they terminate the long list of Grecian philosophers who may be justly praised, notwithstanding their defects, as the wisest and most virtuous of their contemporaries. The writings of Simplicius are now extant. His physical and metaphysical commentaries on Aristotle have passed away with the fashion of the times, but his moral interpretation of Epictetus is preserved in the Library of Nations as a classic book most excellently adapted to direct the will, to purify the heart, and to confirm the understanding by just confidence in the nature both of God and man. About the same time that Pythagoras first invented the appellation of philosopher, liberty and the consulship were founded at Rome by the elder Brutus. The revolutions of the consular office, which may be viewed in the successive lights of a substance, a shadow, and a name, have been occasionally mentioned in the present history. The first magistrates of the Republic had been chosen by the people to exercise, in the Senate and in the camp, the powers of peace and war, which were afterwards translated to the emperors. But the tradition of ancient dignity was long revered by the Romans and barbarians. A Gothic historian applauds the consulship of Theodoric as the height of all temporal glory and greatness. The king of Italy himself congratulated those annual favorites of fortune who, without the cares, enjoyed the splendor of the throne. And at the end of 1,000 years, 2 consuls were created by the sovereigns of Rome and Constantinople for the sole purpose of giving a date to the year and a festival to the people. That the expenses of this festival, in which the wealthy and the vain aspire to surpass their predecessors, insensibly arose to the enormous sum of 80,000 pounds. The wisest senators declined a useless honour, which involved the certain ruin of their families, and to this reluctance I should impute the frequent chasms in the last age of the consular fusti. The predecessors of Justinian had asserted, from the public treasures, the dignity of the less opulent candidates. The avarice of that prince preferred the cheaper and more convenient method of advice and regulation. 7 processions, or spectacles, were the number to which his edict confined the horse and chariot races, the athletic sports, the music and pantomimes of the theatre, and the hunting of wild beasts. And small pieces of silver were discreetly substituted to the gold medals, which had always excited tumult and drunkenness when they were scattered with a profuse hand among the populace. Notwithstanding these precautions and his own example, the succession of consuls finally ceased in the 13th year of Justinian, whose despotic temper might be gratified by the silent extinction of a title which admonished the Romans of their ancient freedom. Yet the annual consulship still lived in the minds of the people. They fondly expected its speedy restoration. They applauded the gracious condescension of successive princes by whom it was assumed in the 1st year of their reign. And 3 centuries elapsed after the death of Justinian, before that obsolete dignity which had been suppressed by custom could be abolished by law. The imperfect mode of distinguishing each year by the name of a magistrate was usefully supplied by the date of a permanent era. The creation of the world, according to the Septuagint version, was adopted by the Greeks, and the Latins, since the age of Charlemagne, have computed their time from the birth of Christ. Chapter 41. Conquests of Justinian in the West. Character and first campaigns of Belisarius. He invades and subdues the Vandal kingdom of Africa. His triumph. The Gothic War. He recovers Sicily, Naples, and Rome. Siege of Rome by the Goths. Their retreat and losses. Surrender of Ravenna. glory of Belisarius. His domestic shame and misfortunes. Part 1. When Justinian ascended the throne, about 50 years after the fall of the Western Empire, the kingdoms of the Goths and Vandals had obtained a solid, and as it might seem, a legal establishment, both in Europe and Africa. The titles which Roman victory had inscribed were erased with equal justice by the sword of the barbarians, and their successful rapine derived a more venerable sanction from time, from treaties, and from the oaths of fidelity already repeated by a second or third generation of obedient subjects. Experience and Christianity had refuted the superstitious hope that Rome was founded by the gods to reign forever over the nations of the earth. But the proud claim of perpetual and indefeasible dominion, which her soldiers could no longer maintain, was firmly asserted by her statesmen and lawyers, whose opinions have been sometimes revived and propagated in the modern schools of jurisprudence. After Rome herself had been stripped of the imperial purple, the princes of Constantinople assumed the sole and sacred scepter of the monarchy. Demanded as their rightful inheritance the provinces which had been subdued by the consuls or possessed by the Caesars, and feebly aspired to deliver their faithful subjects of the West from the usurpation of heretics and barbarians. The execution of this splendid design was in some degree reserved for Justinian. During the 5 first years of his reign, he reluctantly waged a costly and unprofitable war against the Persians, till his pride submitted to his ambition, and he purchased at the price of 440,000 pounds sterling the benefit of a precarious truce, which, in the language of both nations, was dignified with the appellation of the Endless Peace. The safety of the East enabled the emperor to employ his forces against the Vandals, and the internal state of Africa afforded an honorable motive and promised a powerful support to the Roman arms. According to the testament of the founder, the African kingdom had lineally descended to Hilderic, the eldest of the Vandal princes. A mild disposition inclined the son of a tyrant, the grandson of a conqueror, to prefer the counsels of clemency and peace, and his accession was marked by the salutary edict which restored 200 bishops to their churches and allowed the free profession of the Athanasian Creed. But the Catholics accepted, with cold and transient gratitude, a favor so inadequate to their pretensions, and the virtues of Hilderic offended the prejudices of his countrymen. The Arian clergy presumed to insinuate that he had renounced the faith, and the soldiers more loudly complained that he had degenerated from the courage of his ancestors. His ambassadors were suspected of a secret and disgraceful negotiation in the Byzantine court, and his general, the Achilles, as he was named, of the Vandals, lost a battle against the naked and disorderly Moors. The public discontent was exasperated by Gelimer, whose age, descent, and military fame gave him an apparent title to the succession. He assumed, with the consent of the nation, the reins of government, and his unfortunate sovereign sunk without a struggle from the throne to a dungeon, where he was strictly guarded with a faithful counsellor, and his unpopular nephew, the Achilles of the Vandals. But the indulgence which Hilderic had shown to his Catholic subjects had powerfully recommended him to the favour of Justinian, who, for the benefit of his own sect, could acknowledge the use and justice of religious toleration. Their alliance, while the nephew of Justin remained in a private station, was cemented by the mutual exchange of gifts and letters, and the Emperor Justinian asserted the cause of royalty and friendship. In 2 successive embassies he admonished the usurper to repent of his treason, or to abstain at least from any further violence which might provoke the displeasure of God and of the Romans, to reverence the laws of kindred and succession, and to suffer an infirm old man peaceably to end his days either on the throne of Carthage or in the palace of Constantinople. The passions, or even the prudence, of Gelimer compelled him to reject these requests, which were urged in the haughty tone of menace and command. And he justified his ambition in a language rarely spoken in the Byzantine court by alleging the right of a free people to remove or punish their chief magistrate, who had failed in the execution of the kingly office. After this fruitless expostulation, the captive monarch was more rigorously treated, his nephew was deprived of his eyes, and the cruel Vandal, confident in his strength and distance, derided the vain threats and slow preparations of the Emperor of the East. Justinian resolved to deliver or revenge his friend, Gelimer to maintain his usurpation, and the war was preceded, according to the practice of civilized nations, by the most solemn protestations that each party was sincerely desirous of peace. The report of an African war was grateful only to the vain and idle populace of Constantinople, whose poverty exempted them from tribute, and whose cowardice was seldom exposed to military service. But the wiser citizens who judged of the future by the past revolved in their memory the immense loss, both of men and money, which the empire had sustained in the expedition of Basiliscus. The troops, which, after five laborious campaigns, had been recalled from the Persian frontier, dreaded the sea, the climate, and the arms of an unknown enemy. The ministers of the finances computed, as far as they might compute, the demands of an African war. The taxes which must be found and levied to supply those insatiate demands, and the danger lest their own lives, or at least their lucrative employments, should be made responsible for the deficiency of the supply. Inspired by such selfish motives, for we may not suspect him of any zeal for the public good, John of Cappadocia ventured to oppose in full council the inclinations of his master. He confessed that a victory of such importance could not be too dearly purchased, but he represented in a grave discourse the certain difficulties and the uncertain event. "You undertake," said the prefect, "to besiege Carthage. By land the distance is not less than 140 days' journey. On the sea, a whole year must elapse before you can receive any intelligence from your fleet. If Africa should be reduced, it cannot be preserved without the additional conquest of Sicily and Italy. Success will impose the obligations of new labors. A single misfortune will attract the barbarians into the heart of your exhausted empire." Justinian felt the weight of this salutary advice. He was confounded by the unwonted freedom of an obsequious servant, and the design of the war would perhaps have been relinquished if his courage had not been revived by a voice which silenced the doubts of profane reason. "I have seen a vision," cried an artful or fanatic bishop of the East. "It is the will of heaven, O Emperor, that you should not abandon your holy enterprise for the deliverance of the African Church. The God of battles will march before your standard and disperse your enemies, who are the enemies of his son." The emperor might be tempted, and his counselors were constrained, to give credit to this seasonable revelation. But they derived more rational hope from the revolt which the adherents of Hilderic, or Athanasius, had already excited on the borders of the Vandal monarchy. Prudentius, an African subject, had privately signified his loyal intentions, and a small military aid restored the province of Tripoli to the obedience of the Romans. The government of Sardinia had been entrusted to Godas. A valiant barbarian, he suspended the payment of tribute, disclaimed his allegiance to the usurper, and gave audience to the emissaries of Justinian, who found him master of that fruitful island at the head of his guards, and proudly invested with the ensigns of royalty. The forces of the Vandals were diminished by discord and suspicion. The Roman armies were animated by the spirit of Belisarius, one of those heroic names which are familiar to every age and to every nation. the Africanus of New Rome was born, and perhaps educated, among the Thracian peasants, without any of those advantages which had formed the virtues of the elder and younger Scipio, a noble origin, liberal studies, and the emulation of a free state. The silence of a loquacious secretary may be admitted to prove that the youth of Belisarius could not afford any subject of praise. He served, most assuredly, with valour and reputation among the private guards of Justinian, and when his patron became emperor, the domestic was promoted to military command. After a bold inroad into Persarmenia, in which his glory was shared by a colleague and his progress was checked by an enemy, Belisarius repaired to the important station of Dara, where he first accepted the service of Procopius, the faithful companion and diligent historian of his exploits. The Meranes of Persia advanced with 40,000 of her best troops to raise the fortifications of Dara, and signified the day and the hour on which the citizen should prepare a bath for his refreshment after the toils of victory. He encountered an adversary equal to himself by the new title of General of the East. His superior in the science of war, but much inferior in the number and quality of his troops, which amounted only to 25,000 Romans and strangers, relaxed in their discipline and humbled by recent disasters. As the level plain of Dara refused all shelter to stratagem and ambush, Belisarius protected his front with a deep trench, which was prolonged at first in perpendicular and afterwards in parallel lines to cover the wings of cavalry advantageously posted to command the flanks and rear of the enemy. When the Roman centre was shaken, their well-timed and rapid charge decided the conflict. The standard of Persia fell. The immortals fled. The infantry threw away their bucklers, and 8,000 of the vanquished were left on the field of battle. In the next campaign, Syria was invaded on the side of the desert, and Belisarius, with 20,000 men, hastened from Dara to the relief of the province. During the whole summer, the designs of the enemy were baffled by his skillful dispositions. He pressed their retreat, occupied each night their camp of the preceding day, and would have secured a bloodless victory if he could have resisted the impatience of his own troops. Their valiant promise was faintly supported in the hour of battle. The right wing was exposed by the treacherous or cowardly desertion of the Christian Arabs. The Huns, a veteran band of 800 warriors, were oppressed by superior numbers. The flight of the Isaurians was intercepted, but the Roman infantry stood firm on the left, for Belisarius himself, dismounting from his horse, showed them that intrepid despair was their only safety. They turned their backs to the Euphrates and their faces to the enemy. Innumerable arrows glanced without effect from the compact and shelving order of their bucklers. An impenetrable line of pikes was opposed to the repeated assaults of the Persian cavalry, and after a resistance of many hours, the remaining troops were skillfully embarked under the shadow of the night. The Persian commander retired with disorder and disgrace to answer a strict account of the lives of so many soldiers which he had consumed in a barren victory. But the fame of Belisarius was not sullied by a defeat, in which he alone had saved his army from the consequences of their own rashness. The approach of peace relieved him from the guard of the eastern frontier, and his conduct in the sedition of Constantinople amply discharged his obligations to the emperor. When the African war became the topic of popular discourse and secret deliberation, each of the Roman generals was apprehensive rather than ambitious of the dangerous honor. But as soon as Justinian had declared his preference of superior merit, their envy was rekindled by the unanimous applause which was given to the choice of Belisarius. The temper of the Byzantine court may encourage a suspicion that the hero was darkly assisted by the intrigues of his wife, the fair and subtle Antonina, who alternately enjoyed the confidence and incurred the hatred of the Empress Theodora. The birth of Antonina was ignoble. She descended from a family of charioteers, and her chastity has been stained with the foulest reproach. yet she reigned with long and absolute power over the mind of her illustrious husband. And if Antonina disdained the merit of conjugal fidelity, she expressed a manly friendship to Belisarius, whom she accompanied with undaunted resolution in all the hardships and dangers of a military life. The preparations for the African War were not unworthy of the last contest between Rome and Carthage. The pride and flower of the army consisted of the guards of Belisarius, who, according to the pernicious indulgence of the times, devoted themselves by a particular oath of fidelity to the service of their patrons. Their strength and stature, for which they had been curiously selected, the goodness of their horses and armor, and the assiduous practice of all the exercises of war, enabled them to act whatever their courage might prompt, and their courage was exalted by the social honor of their rank and the personal ambition of favor and fortune. 400 of the bravest of the Heruli marched under the banner of the faithful and active Pharas. Their untractable valor was more highly prized than the tame submission of the Greeks and Syrians, and of such importance was it deemed to procure a reinforcement of 600 Massageti, or Huns, that they were allured by fraud and deceit to engage in a naval expedition. 5,000 horse and 10,000 foot were embarked at Constantinople for the conquest of Africa. But the infantry, for the most part levied in Thrace and Isauria, yielded to the more prevailing use and reputation of the cavalry, and the Scythian bow was the weapon on which the armies of Rome were now reduced to place their principal dependence. From a laudable desire to assert the dignity of his theme, Procopius defends the soldiers of his own time against the morose critics who confined that respectable name to the heavy-armed warriors of antiquity, and maliciously observed that the word archer is introduced by Homer as a term of contempt. Such contempt might perhaps be due to the naked youths who appeared on foot in the fields of Troy, and lurking behind a tombstone or the shield of a friend, drew the bowstring to their breast, and dismissed a feeble and lifeless arrow. But our archers, pursues the historian, are mounted on horses, which they manage with admirable skill. Their head and shoulders are protected by a casque or buckler. They wear greaves of iron on their legs, and their bodies are guarded by a coat of mail. On their right side hangs a quiver, a sword on their left, and their hand is accustomed to wield a lance or javelin in closer combat. Their bows are strong and weighty. They shoot in every possible direction, advancing, retreating, to the front, to the rear, or to either flank. And as they are taught to draw the bowstring not to the breast, but to the right ear, firm indeed must be the armor that can resist the rapid violence of their shaft. 500 transports, navigated by 20,000 mariners of Egypt, Cilicia, and Ionia, were collected in the harbour of Constantinople. The smallest of these vessels may be computed at 30, the largest at 500 tons, and the fair average will supply an allowance, liberal but not profuse, of about 100,000 tons for the reception of 35,000 soldiers and sailors, of 5,000 horses, of arms, engines, and military stores, and of a sufficient stock of water and provisions for a voyage, perhaps, of 3 months. The proud galleys which in former ages swept the Mediterranean with so many hundred oars had long since disappeared, and the fleet of Justinian was escorted only by 92 light brigantines, covered from the missile weapons of the enemy and rowed by 2,000 of the brave and robust youth of Constantinople. 22 generals are named, most of whom were afterwards distinguished in the wars of Africa and Italy. But the supreme command, both by land and sea, was delegated to Belisarius alone, with a boundless power of acting according to his discretion, as if the emperor himself were present. The separation of the naval and military professions is at once the effect and the cause of the modern improvements in the science of navigation and maritime war. in the 7th year of the reign of Justinian, and about the time of the summer solstice, the whole fleet of 600 ships was ranged in martial pomp before the gardens of the palace. The patriarch pronounced his benediction, the emperor signified his last commands, the general's trumpet gave the signal of departure, and every heart, according to its fears or wishes, explored with anxious curiosity the omens of misfortune and success. The first halt was made at Perinthus, or Heraclea, where Belisarius waited 5 days to receive some Thracian horses, a military gift of his sovereign. From thence the fleet pursued their course through the midst of the Propontis, but as they struggled to pass the straits of the Hellespont, an unfavorable wind detained them 4 days at Abydos, where the general exhibited a memorable lesson of firmness and severity. Two of the Huns, who in a drunken quarrel had slain one of their fellow soldiers, were instantly shown to the army suspended on a lofty gibbet. The national dignity was resented by their countrymen, who disclaimed the servile laws of the empire and asserted the free privilege of Scythia, where a small fine was allowed to expiate the hasty sallies of intemperance and anger. Their complaints were specious, their clamors were loud, and the Romans were not averse to the example of disorder and impunity. But the rising sedition was appeased by the authority and eloquence of the general, and he represented to the assembled troops the obligations of justice, the importance of discipline, the rewards of piety and virtue, and the unpardonable guilt of murder, which, in his apprehension, was aggravated rather than excused by the vice of intoxication. In the navigation from the Hellespont to Peloponnesus, which the Greeks, after the siege of Troy, had performed in 4 days, the fleet of Belisarius was guided in their course by his master galley, conspicuous in the day by the redness of the sails, and in the night by the torches blazing from the masthead. It was the duty of the pilots, as they steered between the islands and turned the capes of Malea and Tinarium, to preserve the just order and regular intervals of such a multitude of ships. As the wind was fair and moderate, their labors were not unsuccessful, and the troops were safely disembarked at Methone, on the Messenian coast, to repose themselves for a while after the fatigues of the sea. In this place they experienced how avarice, invested with authority, may sport with the lives of thousands which are bravely exposed for the public service. According to military practice, the bread or biscuit of the Romans was twice prepared in the oven, and the diminution of 1/4 was cheerfully allowed for the loss of weight. To gain this miserable profit and to save the expense of wood, the prefect, John of Cappadocia, had given orders that the flour should be slightly baked by the same fire which warmed the baths of Constantinople. And when the sacks were opened, a soft and mouldy paste was distributed to the army. Such unwholesome food, assisted by the heat of the climate and season, soon produced an epidemical disease which swept away 500 soldiers. Their health was restored by the diligence of Belisarius, who provided fresh bread at Methone and boldly expressed his just and humane indignation. The emperor heard his complaint. The general was praised, but the minister was not punished. From the port of Methone, the pilots steered along the western coast of Peloponnesus as far as the Isle of Zakynthos, or Zante, before they undertook the voyage, in their eyes a most arduous voyage, of 100 leagues over the Ionian Sea. As the fleet was surprised by a calm, 16 days were consumed in the slow navigation, and even the general would have suffered the intolerable hardship of thirst if the ingenuity of Antonina had not preserved the water in glass bottles, which she buried deep in the sand in a part of the ship impervious to the rays of the sun. At length the harbour of Caucana, on the southern side of Sicily, afforded a secure and hospitable shelter. The Gothic officers who governed the island in the name